This is Sid Haig from www.sidhaig.com, and you are listening to the Ghostly Pod. That's the only reason I don't have my boot up your ass.
Ghostly Talk, go to addunderground.com and click on Slack and Radio every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Check out past shows of Ghostly Talk.
Glenn Kimball is an author, educator, and lecturer. He has successfully completed all coursework for a PhD in communications. So hopefully we can learn something. He was the former president of International Exchange School and has taught school at Southern Illinois University. He has been collecting ancient texts since the age of 15 and is famous for being able to integrate very diverse texts into a contiguous storyline. Due to the censorship of time and doubt, most of the documents and oral stories chronicling the early life of Jesus were destroyed, lost, or forgotten. After 25 years of research, during which Kimball visited museums, Indian tribes, medicine men, and universities, he assembled some of the missing links and unsolved mysteries of Christianity. His website is www.ancientmanuscripts.com, and we would like to welcome Glenn Kimball. Welcome to Ghostly Talk.
Nice to be with you.
Very nice. Thank you for coming on the show, Glenn. I think I was going through some of the notes and stuff that you sent me via email a while back, and to be quite honest with you, I'm still like, my mind started to like stretch inside my skull as I read this stuff. And I'm really glad we have you here to try to put some light on this, because I'm like, whoa, this is heavy.
Well, I was just thinking that this may also be a time-based kind of, very, very fortunate happenstance in time,
mm-hmm.
because right on the Ghostly Talk homepage, Havoc had put up a news piece
yeah.
that was covered on MSNBC about they discovered they dated it to between 900 and 1,000. They were digging in a bog in Ireland, and they found an ancient text. They found, well, if it was between 900 and 1,000, AD, it was obviously very old,
mm-hmm.
and they found this text of a whole bunch of different psalms. I believe
it was a text. It was a piece of psalms.
It was all the psalms, and it happened to be open to a page about Israel, as a matter of fact, which is kind of freaky.
Ironically,
yeah. But Glenn, did you happen to see that piece or read about this ancient book that just happened to be found?
Well, I did, and we tend to think in our world that with Saint Patrick was the one who brought Christianity to Ireland, and that's complete crapola. Pardon me, but. We listen so often to our university professors, and pardon me, to the National Geographic Society, that we actually think that they know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they sure come across like they do, and sometimes half the battle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the reality is that by the time of Christ, there were 40 different tribal entities in the British Isles, and there were 60,000 students going to school there. They were taking classes from a group that the Romans called the Magi. They were really a branch of the Druidic, of the Druids.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been around for 2,700 years. They had been teaching their schools all over the world. The emperors in China had them at their side. A royal family of members of India, the Egyptians had had them all the way back to the time of Menes. They literally traveled the world. And the reason why these men were so famous was because they had knowledge about the stars. Now, the stars were critical not because of the movements of the planets per se or astronomic physics or the revolution of the planets. The reason why the stars were important is because they used them to navigate the oceans. Merchant traffic was very critical to these nations. It fed them. It brought them money. Trade was lucrative in those days, even as far back as 2,700 years B.C. And we find some of these princes along in the Gobi Desert still mummified from at least 1,600 years B.C. With these Druid tattoos on their cheeks and red hair and British tartans,
mm-hmm.
dressed in that plaid, the British tartan plaid. These men were everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they were also famous for one thing, and that was they were famous for looking for the coming of their Messiah. In fact, they were the ones, their society, three of their members of their society, were assigned to visit the birth of Christ, and did come about a year after he was born, and brought a king's ransom of gold, frankincense, and myrrh to Jesus' family, which made his family wealthy. Even though they were already wealthy, it would have made 100 families wealthy for many generations. We tend to think that Jesus was some poor little kid from the desert, wandered around in the dust, made wooden fences and spoons, and didn't know what he was doing until the 3 years before his final mission. Whoever made up that story needs to write for Disney.
Well, that does. You're right. It does not make sense. I mean, everybody, even in, on the one hand, you've got even Christmas songs saying, you know, oh, they bring all these gifts and, you know, whatever to the event of the birth.
Yeah,
and then he's wandering around in the desert, you know, doing minor miracles and you know, eating crusts or whatever. It sort of is a little bit discontinuous.
Well, that's the thing, is that there's a timeline here that you mentioned, Doug, and that we're going to talk about a little bit here. Are we talking about things that, you know, how he got from point A to point B? I mean, what is his timeline? This is what you're filling in. Am I correct, Glenn?
Yeah, it is, and I want to make one final comment. One of the very first groups of people to blend in with Christianity, the reason why it grew so fast, one of those groups that blended in with Christianity, merged with Christianity, were these Druids.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not talking about the Druids of the day today that wear the white sheets and wander around worship the, you know, plant life and animals.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the real Druids, the ones who were very, very intelligent. During Jesus' life, it says in John, in the New Testament, and John knew him best. In fact, he was Jesus' best friend. John says, and John 21:25, he says, and many things Jesus did, I suppose if they were all written, the world itself could not contain all the books that should be written. Now, that does not describe a little wandering nobody wandering around the deserts of Judea not knowing what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
It describes a person who was cosmopolitan, somebody who was very active through his whole life, somebody who did a whole bunch of stuff. It makes the Bible seem like I don't want to critique the Bible because there are a lot of people who think that the Bible is the only thing that exists about Jesus, but there's only 70-some-odd sayings of Jesus in the Bible. My wife says 70 things an hour.
Right, right.
Every hour. And how could Jesus have gotten that popular on 70 things? You know, that's absolutely ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact there were many different groups of people who had expected Jesus to come into the world and quietly merged with Christianity after the crucifixion, and that's how Christianity grew so quickly, was that there were pockets of people who were looking for him to come.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And they were absorbed into Christianity whole hog. I mean, we think that the missions of the apostles after the death of Christ was one at a time knocking on doors like they do today. You know, that's not true. That's not true.
That's just annoying. I'm sorry to say that. Beating on the door, that just drives me crazy. That's my personal opinion.
This was thousands of people at a time were merging with Christianity after the death of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to understand that there are a lot of people, and I really love picking on the National Geographic Society, and the reason why is because they really do think they know everything. They have gone to Egypt and bought up all the sites
mm-hmm.
that have to do with Jesus' business in Egypt. They've even bought this new book called The Gospel of Judas
mm-hmm.
and have published it. And then they've come out and said, hey, look, you know, this book, this one single book, is going to revolutionize everything we know about Jesus. And my comment is, what are you smoking? You know, don't smoke the herbs. Film the herbs, okay?
Film the herbs. Well, why did you start at 15? What drew you to collecting all these stories and these ancient manuscripts because obviously, did you have a feeling that down the line you were going to put together an entire story like this and figure
it
out?
Absolutely not. That had nothing to do with it. My father was a Greek historian, And my father would never come to a baseball game. I was an athlete. He'd never come to a football game, never come to a basketball game. Didn't care one iota about what I did athletically. And I loved my father.
Mm-hmm.
But my father would sit down and talk to me about ancient texts. And so I, in order to facilitate communication in my home, which I felt was important from a very young child, I began collecting texts and talking to my father about them.
That's kind of like AC/DC with me and my dad. That's how we communicate. I mean, it's funny, but it's interesting you mention that, because there is those things that you have in order to facilitate communication like that. And that's what I mean. It's goofy, but it's the first thing I thought of.
A common thread. And you started collecting these texts. And when did they start to form this story that fills in and teaches everybody a lot more than, you know, National Geographic and all these other folks who who have these, you know, buy up these pieces of land and libraries? And when did it start to form this story?
You know, that's a really good question, because that really wasn't the case to begin with. The dots didn't start connecting themselves together until about 10 years ago, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd spent some time in Bolivia, and I remember sitting there in the jungles, meeting with two Catholic priests who were in exile from the Vatican Library. And they gotten too close to the Vatican Library, and they got sent to outer Bolivia.
Oh,
literally.
My God.
I've heard other cases like that, so I believe
and
it.
And they began
yeah.
to teach me about some of the texts that were in the Vatican Library. And at that time, you know, it was like, oh, really? And no big deal. And I'd sit and listen for a while, because that's something they love to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And I befriended the priest, but, you know, it never dawned on me how significant that was until for 20 years afterwards. Because I befriended them in 1968 in the Amazon jungle. So, but, you know, and I also had befriended, because it was kind of a fun thing to do, is I follow Carlos Castaneda's into Oaxaca.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember who Carlos Castaneda's was, but Carlos Castaneda's mm-hmm. wrote the book The Yaqui Way of Knowledge and talked about the brujas and the spiritualism of the Yaqui Indian Nation,
mm-hmm.
how to become a sorcerer. And I also spent some considerable time with the medicine men in the Amazon jungle and with the Amadon, the Quechua, and the Andes Mountains, and with the heirs to the Inca throne in Peru. And it was more of a lark for me. But looking back now, all of those things made a significant inroad into what was going on, because the Native American Indians, our good Native brothers, have secrets that they have not told us.
Well, I imagine I'm sure there's a lot of secrets they have that we'll probably never find out about.
Well, you know, and so it even became more personal this month. We did a show for one of the things I do professionally is we do major outdoor water laser fire fireworks shows outside.
Wow.
And I'm talking about, you know, the top of the line, state of the art type things, you know, animation in the sky type things.
Oh, wow.
Where you can have a monster step right out of the clouds into your backyard, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, literally. And we did a show for one of the Native American Indian casinos, and it was for the 4th of July this month. And I wrote the show, and I was writing the show on a Native American Indian theme, and I knew what they were going to do. The tribal elders came back and said, take all references of the Native American Indians out of this show. And it's an old story for me. But I said, okay, well, how come? And they said, because we are the only ones who have the right to teach our own people. We don't want you being involved. We have secret things that we tell our sons and our daughters. We don't even let them speak about it in public. And, I mean, they were adamant. They were furious that we would include Native American Indians in the 4th of July presentation. And there's a reason for that. Because there are things that they do not talk about on CNN or with anthropologists. There are things that they do not talk about when white men are around.
Mm-hmm.
There are things that they only talk about when they are in the sweat lodges,
mm-hmm.
In their sacred circles by themselves, to themselves, for themselves. And if you want to know what those things are, we've been conducting ancient manuscript classes for the last 2 months, and one of them is called He Walked the Americas. Came out this month. It's on my website. If you take the class, I will knock you down. I will change your life the way you think about Native American Indians. There are things that they do not tell you. They have been expecting the return of their pale prophet. And did you know what the Mayans called him?
No.
They called him Yehovah.
Mm-hmm.
Yehovah. Oh, okay. Oh, okay. It took me a second for that to sink in. I'm sorry, Glenn. I'm like...
That actually...
You gotta be home upstairs.
Yeah.
That actually combines with other religions that are expecting, you know, returns of their prophets and things like that. Mm. So,
Did you know that there are 6 Mayan tribes in the Yucatan Peninsula that have not surfaced? They're still under the green canopy of the forest. That CNN, the National Geographic, have never found. Thank goodness they didn't ruin them.
Yeah.
That still
here,
live
have
underground.
Nike shoes. Yeah. Oh, great.
They still live underground in the temples, and that they have a book that's 800 pages long. Do you know what? Do you know how I know?
How did you find this out?
They visited me.
Okay.
They knew what I was writing, and they visited me.
What, okay.
They are waiting for the time when they are commanded by their pale prophet to disclose what they know. And what they know, I know what they know. I've got a copy of what they know. What they know is a copy of the temple protocol that was once used in the Temple of Solomon.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. No kidding.
Wow.
And they have a copy about the origins of the earth, which is very similar to the Adam and Eve story. And it has a copy of the prophecies of the end of the earth.
Well, wait a minute, Glenn. I mean, just on a high level here, because I mean, I'm an absolute layman in what we're discussing here. But you said, and I never I always make jokes about this to people. Is it's like you hear, there's certain things I don't expect to hear in the same sentence. And Temple of Solomon and Indians are two of those things I had never thought I'd ever hear.
Well, as far as Mayans.
Well, the Mayans.
Well, you see, we don't even most 99.999% of the Western American Christians don't know what I'm talking about either.
Uh-huh.
They think that the Temple of Solomon and the Temple of Herod was a place that you'd go and sacrifice a couple of doves and burn some incense, and whoop-de-doo, we had a party. You know, that's not what it was at all. The protocol of the temple was a 6-hour program of education and ceremonies and intense activity. It took you 6 hours to do this process.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, that's exactly what the Templars found in when they went there in 1118. The original 9 French Templars originally called themselves the Fraternal Order of St. John, or John.
Mm-hmm.
When they went to dig in the Temple Mound, they found something. They found something that changed their lives, that they put on the back of a horse and galloped it back quickly, on the gallop, back to France. And, you know, the National Geographic Channel, let me just pick on them to death. The National Geographic Channel says, it must have been the Holy Grail. And my comment is, well, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Because, first of all, the Holy Grail was already in Britain. But secondly of all, the Holy Grail wouldn't have made them rich. What they found in the Temple Mound made them instantly rich beyond measure, mm-hmm. overnight. The National Geographic Channel had another theory. They said that what they found was blackmail, and the fact that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene, and they blackmailed the Vatican, and that's how they got rich. Well, I'm sorry. The Templars were a chivalrous order who prided themselves in their honor, wouldn't have blackmailed anybody, and considered themselves the allies of the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what they found. What they found was the same thing that Hiram of Tyre found 2,000 years prior to the Templars. He found exactly the same thing. There was precedent for what the Templars found. What they found was the sacred and secret temple protocol. The Bible talks about having to build a temple before the coming of the Messiah. Otherwise, the earth would be wasted at his coming.
Mm-hmm.
The Jewish Knesset has sent a group to America over 10 years ago. They already have the building blocks and the construction materials to build that temple on the Temple Mount. They just don't know what it's to be used for.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, the Jews never knew what they were supposed to be used for. They were out of the loop. The Jews had diverged in the yellow wood before the time of Christ and went west. They were out of the loop. They had lost their inheritance. They had lost entirely what they were doing. They had lost their path. It was the Christians who understood it when they came. When Jesus turned over the money changers' temples, tables, it was evidence of the fact that he knew exactly what was going on. Anyway, and the guys who had the money changers' tables outside were Annas and Caiaphas, who were the Hasmonean dynasty Jews who were collecting a tick off all the tithing that people were bringing to their temple. And so by the time of the Templars, they found this temple protocol. They wrote it back to France, and all they had to do was to announce to the people there who were already waiting. They said to them, look, we have found a way to get the temples back into operation again. And everybody, the poor and rich, offered everything that they had financially to put that temple back into operation. That's how they got wealthy overnight. That's exactly how they got wealthy overnight. And that's also the reason why the existing Christian churches were so adamantly opposed to them. Because by that time, in the 12th century, and especially by 1307, when they issued the extermination order for the Templars,
mm-hmm.
they were collecting the tithing at the cathedrals of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And if they put the temple back in operation, that would completely undermine the basis for their financial support of their cathedrals. They had replaced the cathedrals with these artifacts, like a sliver of the true cross of Christ, or the shroud of Turin baloney, you know,
mm-hmm.
or some other bone of some saint, you know.
Mm-hmm. And
they used that to elicit pilgrimages so that people would come from long distances, bring their money, and pay their tithing in these cathedrals. Because they had lost what the temples were all about, where the people really should have been paying their tithing, where really would have done it. And that cost the Templars their lives.
Yeah.
It was a financial decision.
Yeah.
It was an open threat. You have to ask, why would the Vatican exterminate all the Templars who had given up their lives to support the Vatican? This sounds like a samurai story to me,
mm-hmm.
you know, where the samurai were supporting the emperor of Japan. And the emperor ended up slaughtering them, you know.
It's the same kind of story.
And it sounds like we just saw it in Star Wars Episode 3 as well.
It is. It's very similar to Star Wars Episode 3.
Yeah, they did the exact same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that was fictitious, but it was obviously based, you know, it was inspired.
Inspired by something.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Glenn.
This temple protocol is the same temple protocol that the Native American Indians have. As a matter of fact, if you knew how to read it, it's you know this Mayan stone calendar you see all the time?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
The temple protocol is written in that calendar.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness. And that's something I've never heard before as far as the calendar is concerned. Because you hear about the Mayan calendar all the time. And all the ideas on that. I've never heard that take, that may be written. You said that's written into the calendar itself?
Yeah. If you knew how to read it, which I have had some friends who've spent 30 years deciphering the codes, what has boiled it out from that is the exact protocol of the temple. And this protocol is something that no one would talk about, not even me, outside the walls of the temple. They didn't do it then, and they won't do it now. That's part of the reason why they're keeping it quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, the first thing that's lost is the thing that you keep sacred or secret.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing that gets lost in history.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is the thing that got lost. However, the entire world had it. They had it in China. This is why Kublai Khan in China sent Marco Polo's father, Matteo, and his uncle, Niccolo, back to pick up Marco Polo with a specific request. Do you know what Kublai Khan, the emperor of China, asked them for? He could have asked them for trade agreements. He could have asked them for gold, for medicine, for weapons. What did he ask for? He asked for 100 Christian priests and a significant quantity of consecrated oil from the Temple of Jerusalem.
Oh, my God. See, I never thought these religions, let's say. I mean, what I'm getting out of this right now, Glenn, is that and it's an idea that I think a lot of people embrace, is that we all kind of believe in the same thing. Why are we all fighting all the time? That's kind of what I'm getting out of this a little bit. And what I'm hearing from you is that these ideas, the protocols, they're universal. Not universal, they're global. They're shared by us all. Like you said, this is the world. This belongs to the world.
It does belong to the world. And we're coming up on those end times in the world. I'm not a prophet, and I'm not a doomsdayer.
Mm-hmm.
We're coming up to that time in history that's been prophesied where we're in for some trouble. That doesn't mean the world's going to end. As a matter of fact, the final chapter of mortality in prophecy has a happy ending, a very happy ending, 1,000 years of peace that no one's ever experienced before.
Why don't we take a break? Why don't we take a quick break, Glenn, and talk more about that after the break? Would that be okay?
Right.
Let's do that. Let's take a quick break. This is Ghostly Talk. I'm Scott Elb.
I'm Doug.
And I'm Bonnie.
And I got an air bubble in my throat. You ever have that?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That just, like, totally knocked me out.
Drink beer upside down.
You know? That's how you have to do it. That'll work.
We'll be right back after this.
This is Lauren Coleman talking to you from a wild corner of America. You can reach me through looking on my website, which is laurencoleman.com, and you're listening to Ghostly Talk. We'll be right back.
Dr. Andrew Nichols with www.parapsychologylab.com. You're listening to Ghostly Talk Radio.
www.ancientmanuscripts.com, where he has courses available and books and everything. He's been collecting this information since the age of 15. Put it together 10 years ago or so that, hey, wait a minute. All these things are integrated somehow.
Yeah.
And it really teaches us a lot about it says here Christianity, but I'm beginning to think almost all religions worldwide that ever have been and ever will be. So that's what Glenn is here discussing. Welcome back to Ghostly Talk, Glenn.
It's good to be back. You know, my dad told me something when I was 8 years old that I'll never forget. He said, the third parties are always negative. Always negative.
The third
parties?
He
said, when you grow up, he says, you'll want to start a business someday, and you'll ask 10 people, 10 of your best friends, should you do it? And don't be surprised if all of them tell you no. And guess what, Glenn? They'll all be wrong.
Right.
And, you know, you can identify a third party because they are predominantly negative. And pardon me, I've taken some shots at the National Geographic. The National Geographic's not unlike any other organization that takes a tick off of everything that they own. Their footage, their media, they're following a good business protocol.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is they don't know anything about religion, and they should have stayed out of that arena. I had to laugh today. They did a show on Nostradamus.
I saw that the other night. It was on late night.
And you know who they asked to be their number one scholar? They asked the editor-in-chief of the Skeptic magazine. I can't imagine, first of all, anyone being that stupid to ask the editor-in-chief of the Skeptic magazine to advance any theory for any reason under any circumstances. He and the Amazing Randy make their living telling people they're stupid for saying things,
mm-hmm.
and they themselves know nothing, you know. that's probably the worst publication there is in existence in terms of wanting to discover anything. If you were to ask that guy, should I try and be an attorney in my life, he'd find a reason to say no. You know, should I be a doctor? Should I?
Mm-hmm.
Am I good enough to be alive? No.
You know, no. Whatever you want to do. No.
You are worthless. Go away.
You're worthless. These guys are the Monday morning quarterbacks trying to evaluate from the grandstands and never played football on the field in their whole life.
Well, to an extent, I feel sorry for them. I was just in a discussion on our forums, on our website. A fellow had, you know, why bother? Why bother, you know, doing this and things like that? And I said, well, the problem is, when I look at a photo or I try to, you know, evaluate some piece of evidence that's been gathered, and I do get this sense of awe and wonder. Now, for a brief moment, and sometimes for a very brief moment, sometimes I still am in awe and wonder over a piece of recorded evidence. But the problem is I can experience that awe and wonder, even if it's only for a moment. And think of possibilities and think of of what does this mean? What could this mean? What, you know, whatever. And then even if later on I reject that piece of evidence and I say, well, you know what, the problem is, you know, this and that and the other thing. But I still had that experience. I still had that wonder and the moment of thinking of all the possibilities. And I don't think that the editor of Skeptic Magazine gets that kind of feeling all that often.
Well, I don't know whether he does or not, but he's certainly paid to be a critic,
mm-hmm.
and that's how he makes his money. And I respect the person. You know, the one thing that the Socrates did for the world was he instituted the public debates, the ability to stand in a forum and challenge the powers that be. An interesting story about that, linking him back to Jesus. We can do that.
Okay.
They eventually, the powers that be at the time of Socrates, forced him to drink hemlock because of what he was doing. They termed it some sort of insurrection. And Socrates, being a brilliant man, says, "Isn't there something else I can do to atone for my insurrection?" And they said, "Well, do you have an idea of what you could do?" And he had 30 pieces of money in his 30 coins in his pocket. And he offered the 30 coins to atone for what he had done, and his captors laughed at that, saying it's worthless. And as a result, 30 pieces of money has come to mean something worthless over many centuries. And you know who knew that best, that story best, was a man named Annas and Caiaphas, who happened to give Judas Iscariot 30 pieces of silver to betray Jesus.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes. Although, you know what's interesting? If you had 30 pieces of money in your pocket or within your robes, however it was, and you offered that, and the problem is after you drink the hemlock,
mm-hmm.
don't those get inherited by you anyway if you happen to be the one standing closest? I mean, it sounds like they got the best of both. kind of morbid.
Well, Judas, when he figured out what he had done, he was the treasurer for the 12 apostles, by the way. He's the one that took care of their money, and they had quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
They traveled a great deal, and we talk about them traveling with no purse or scrip, but pardon me, the family of Christ was well-funded, and so were they.
Mm-hmm.
We think of Peter and Paul, for example, living in the catacombs in Rome. That happens to be the most ridiculous thought anyone has ever had. Peter and Paul lived in the palatial estate of Rufus Pudens, that when they were in Rome, the palatial estate of Rufus Pudens, who, by the way, was the head general for Claudius Caesar, that palatial estate had 400 servants in it. And it was from the Palace of the Britons, which still exists, by the way, across the street from the Vatican, where Christianity was really launched. Judas took the money back and threw it at the feet of Annas and Caiaphas while they were in their temple, by the way,
mm-hmm.
which was another anathema to Jesus, that they would be in charge of anything to do with the temple. Part of the reason why he turned the money changers' tables over twice. And by the way, those tables that were outside the temple, they were called the Bazaar of Annas. In other words, Annas owned all of those money-changing tables and made a small fortune off of taking a tick off the tithing that was being brought into this place.
Mm-hmm.
And when they dismantled the temple, kind of a curious note too, in 70 AD under Titus, and this is recorded on the Arch of Titus right in front of the Colosseum in Rome to this very day. It's on the relief there. They used the money from the gold that they melted down and the silver that they melted down from the Temple of Herod to build the Colosseum. And the Colosseum was used to martyr the Christians.
Yes,
so in essence, they used the value of their temple that they so highly valued to build a facility that would publicly dishonor them. I think that's kind of an interesting.
Well, the irony.
Yeah.
that's the one grabber right there is just the whole irony of both those stories.
Yeah.
That where you do something like that. I mean, I guess it really is a matter of perspective. I mean, a person's perspective changes over time. I guess that's what these people went through, too, where they looked at things completely different a matter of time later, it seems.
Well, the National Geographic Channel came out again. I hate to pick on them all the time.
I'm enjoying it myself.
They made stupid mistakes. They came out with the idea that the cult of Mithras, which was the predominant religion of Rome at the time of Christianity, came on board. They said it was so much like Christianity that Christianity learned from the cult of Mithras and was really organized and developed and formulated by Mithras. And I am amazed at how naive that is. They have no idea where the cult of Mithras came from. The cult of Mithras was extremely, a great deal like Christianity, but it came from the Babylonian orientation, and not through the Judeo-Christian orientation. And Christianity and Judaism is older than the cult of Mithras, not vice versa. They make the logical assumption that because it was Roman, and it was presumably older than Christianity, that they must have taught Christianity. Mm. Well, the same thing happened in Egypt. The ancient Egyptians, those who have written the book like the Bible Fraud, etc., said that Christianity came from ancient Egyptian lore. There are people who say that the Christianity came from any number of a dozen different sources. Everyone wants to take credit for creating Christianity. I'm sorry, they're all wrong. First of all, Christianity couldn't have been created by all those separate organizations because they were very, very different in culture, time, and distance. How could they possibly think that it was created by all those different sources? Because it certainly was not. The fact remains is that the original storyline of the creation of the world, what happened here, and our ultimate demise and our ultimate finality for the world is a story that's older than recorded history. And by the way, it extends all the way back into the times of Atlantis and Lemuria. Mm-hmm. It extends 60,000 years before Adam and Eve came into the world. We tend to think that Adam and Eve, Christians in the Western world, think that Adam and Eve were the first mortals on the planet, and yet the Bible itself says that they were men of old and renown who married with their daughters, who were already here when they came into being. And so Christianity doesn't tell, Western Christianity anyway, doesn't tell the whole story either of the civilizations that have been here, that have had the very identical involvement that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had with God, the deity figure.
My goodness. I mean, the story, you're saying, well, what you're saying is this is the story, a second ago you mentioned, this story is older than Adam and Eve, obviously. It's what you said close to
by six times older or more.
And
it was around 60,000 years ago.
And this is
we know that because we have reliefs and traditions and paintings teachings. We have the Chinese people, for example, can trace their history older than Adam and Eve. The truth of the matter is that we go to the Bible and we look up the old prophet Eber in the Old Testament. Eber is the father of Hebrewism, or in fact, Eber is Hebrew. That's where we get Hebrew from.
Mm-hmm.
Eber had two sons. He had one son was named Peleg, who was there during the great dividing of the world, which was the Tower of Babel, and his son went west and became the father of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But the other son's a very curious son. His name was Joktan. He went east and merged with the civilizations that were already here, who were the Chinese. That's why the Chinese writing and Hebrew writings have some of the identical, similar characters. That study's not something I've done. It's something they've been doing for a couple of decades now, comparing ancient Hebrew and Chinese together as being one and the same.
I've never heard that one before either. That's something brand new to me.
But it makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. When you had spoken earlier that we're approaching the end times, and the end times are going to be, of course, very tumultuous. But then after that, we get you know, we get 1,000 years of peace as no one has ever known it. Does that have anything to do with the end of the Mayan calendar, the 2012 date, or is it in other texts?
I think it has something to do with that, but you see, you're talking to a guy who also knew the heir to the Inca throne,
mm-hmm.
the family itself. Their calendar ends in 2011. I've known some of the hierarchy in Judaism and Coptic Christianity, and their calendar ends in 2008. They got to get their acts together, I guess, because their calendars are all 3 years. But whether or not that's true or not, certainly there's something coming of cataclysmic proportions. We will not all be vaporized by Islamic terrorists. There will be a remnant of us that survive. And the Atlanteans, Plato says the Atlanteans knew that they were expecting the return of Atlantis for 1,000 years of peace. The Lemurians were thinking at the end of the world there will be 1,000 years of peace. Christians talk about it as the millennial 1,000 years of peace. These same stories are like fingerprints, one over the other. They come from identically the same source. They could not possibly have been made up because, first of all, they're too unusual. They're too unique. It's like trying to compare Mount Tour in Glastonbury with the Maricopa Pima Indian Nation flag. They're literally a fingerprint, mm-hmm. identical with each other. You have to ask yourself, how did the Maricopa Indians get the exact fingerprint from Mount Tour in Glastonbury, England? That's an interesting one. On the cover of my CD for this month, from the class this month called The 12 Hides of Glastonbury, I tell you the answer to that. On the cover of it is a fresco painted in the Stoke-Dry Cathedral in 700 A.D. of the death of King Arthur II at the hands of none other than Native American Indians.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how in the heck was he there 700 years before Christopher Columbus? But that tradition is not a myth. It is a reality. It pervades Western Europe. You wouldn't see it on National Geographic because they could not get the guy from the Skeptic magazine to approve it.
Well, I believe that.
Another thing, Glenn, too, is the things you're talking about right now. I mean, as far as in respect to National Geographic, I know myself and Doug, we're both very open-minded people. We're both very open-minded people. We're being floored by this information. My question is, and this is with a lot of media type things, do you think people could really, I mean, people who, you know, I'm a layman too. I mean, I'm one of those people too. Do you really think they could handle this kind of information, though? I mean, do you think a skeptic was put in place there to level this thing off so it would be easier for people to take, so to say, as far as Nostradamus is concerned?
Well, to me it sounds more like they were just flat out, we don't have the information, so we'll just make something up and here you go.
Well,
which okay. is worse than just saying, we don't have the information, so here you go, is making it up and as they go along. I just don't know. I don't think that that's very responsible of them.
Well, it just seems that, I mean, and this is something that we've talked about before, is that information like this is very heavy. It's very involved. There's a lot going on here. There's a lot of things to look at. Do you think
I sympathize with you, and I thoroughly understand the problem. I shouldn't say your problem. I think
I got a lot of problems. Don't worry.
I think once you've identified the problem, you're a lot closer to finding the solution.
Yeah.
That's an old theory. The fact, and it is true. There's a lot of people who hate me intensely, because they would rather preserve their ignorant tradition than they would about learning something new.
Exactly.
But that's okay. I think we were born, in fact, I'm positive we were born into mortality with a veil of forgetfulness over our mind, and we were born here in ignorance for a reason. Ignorance plays a part in the protocol for the reason of mortality. If that were not the case, God would just hand us a handbook and we'd all figure out how to feed ourselves and live in peace and the reason for mortality would vaporize.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for mortality is complex, but something that is understandable. It's the one that we came here to do, the one thing we could not do when we were living in the heavens. And that's, I can say it that simply. Mortality is based on the one thing we can get here that we could not get there. And it would take a while for me to explain that. There is something we could not get here, could not get there. And I can tell you, generally speaking,
mm-hmm.
the one thing we could not get there was experience in exposure to good and evil, because there was no evil there.
Mm-hmm.
You could not hide it from anybody. When you met people, you had perfect communication. You knew each other perfectly when you came up. You knew their entire history as if you had lived their life for them. You knew them intimately well. There was no closet to hide a secret. There were no secrets there. Communication was perfect. This is the only time in our whole existence, and we've lived for eons of time, this is the only time where we can hide a secret. And that ability to hide a secret is critical, plays into the purpose of why we are here. We had to have that time to be able to have a first-hand encounter with good and evil and to learn for ourselves why the heaven, the protocol of the heavens, or the prime directive of the heavens is goodness. We couldn't learn goodness without understanding perfectly what evil is. And unfortunately, we are in that sphere at this moment.
Yes, we are. I agree.
And speaking of the limitations sphere that we're in now.
Yeah. There's this thing called time.
Yeah, time exists here, and our time for this hour is up. Glenn Kimball, www.ancientmanuscripts.com. You've got courses and books, and you've put all this stuff together to teach people more about the things that you've been, I guess, looking at, thinking about, studying, and then putting together since you were 15 years old. That's absolutely commendable. So ancientmanuscripts.com. Glenn, what's up next for you, and then we've got to go.
Well, take the course, and you're gonna take the ride of your life. I am going to be focusing on the course. We counted the number of courses that we could do, and it would take me three lifetimes to do them if we did three a month. And
that's our
schedule right now.
That's something, a lot of material.
I believe it. Everybody, visit ancientmanuscripts.com. Glenn Kimball, thank you for being on Ghostly Talk.
Glenn, hang on.
Good to be with you.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks again for coming out. Hang on the line for 1 second, okay, Glenn? Mm-hmm. We're going to close the show out. We got to go, because coming up next, it's that wonderful, sexy young lady.
Full Moon Radio.
Laura.
Dude.
What's up? Give me an email. I haven't talked to you in a while. We're out of here, though. This is Ghostly Talk. I'm Scott L.
I'm Doug.
And Bonnie, and I'm Bonnie.
Bonnie's reading the chat room.
And I'm slacking.
We'll see you next week.
I'm sorry.
I need to go someplace where man can change
it. Later.
the media, become the media.